Welcome to Prague, We'll Find a Way, our podcast all about progressive rock. And my name is Jay Valade.
I'm Jonathan Block.
And today we were going to talk about Jamie Muir and the early 70s, 73, 74.
Actually, fall of 72.
Oh.
Starting.
So version of King Crimson.
Yeah. And so Jamie joined in the summer, you know, post Earthbound, which is kind of interesting in itself, right? In that we go from back in the day, right? You know, you heard that, and then the next thing you would have heard is Lark's Tongues, and it
right.
was like, what? You know, so, and Jamie stayed through the recording of that, which was January, I think, about January, February. He was gone.
But he toured
the
with
band.
Them, right?
He toured with them substantially that fall tour, which, going from Earthbound to this, no one knew anything about that, right? Unless you had seen the shows, the Zoom, it was really the Zoom club shows in the beginning, which I think would have been September, October of, I think it was October of 72 over in Germany. I think there were three or four shows. But then a bootleg appeared during the CD bootleg era, you know, that was like two CDs of one of the Zoom shows. The sound quality was horrible, but it was like, what? I mean, it was different than anything. Very much a jamming, jazzy kind of even avant-garde band with 20 to 30 minute improvs.
Okay.
The shows were long. They only played what was written at the time for the album. So you got part of the album, but not all the album. I mean, I remember you also got snatches of other songs like Fallen Angel and Lament. Actually, Easy Money, the end of Easy Money was actually Fallen Angel. So there's some cool stuff in that era. It's more challenging music. It kind of like harkens to some of the Thrak Attack-y kind of stuff.
Okay.
Because don't forget, so you've got at some points multiple people playing violins, you know, because David Cross played violin and Jamie Muir could play it. Wet. It's just flutes. I mean, everything just kind of going off.
Yeah.
And then you have the songs from the album as well. And they did Encore with Schizoid Man.
Huh.
And all of a lot of those shows from that era ended up on the not the latest Lark's Tongues box, but whichever one. This is 40th anniversary, so I don't know if it was 30th or 40th. I can't keep track. But it was essentially the album, some unreleased studio stuff, but not a lot, and mainly the shows. Now, there's been another box set that came out recently that's two CDs and two DVDs, similar to
the
Blu-rays,
red.
Just similar to the red we talked about. So it's difference there is that there's no live stuff on it at all. They use that as the opportunity, all the studio stuff, and there's a lot because a lot had already been released. You know, we're talking like multiple takes, you know, like hours of Lark's Tongues.
Okay.
One, all the different parts. Some of it's cool, and you've heard some of it before because it's been out there.
Yeah,
it's funny. The only thing that there's no like more than one take of is I think Book of Saturday, or there's like a couple, or you know, but tons and tons of stuff. So if you like that kind of thing, the latest box is kind of the way to go. So,
got
but
it.
Anyways, I'm getting off track here as far as
so Jamie passed away, and I've seen Bill Bruford put something out, and Robert Fripp put something out about him. It's a very interesting time of Crimson for those who are not huge Crimson aficionados. The Bruford leaves, yes, at the height of right before they release Close to the Edge, you know, with a tour on the horizon. Fripp has dismissed the Earthbound band, right?
Well, they splintered, right?
Right?
So the U.S. tour ends. They didn't, you know, Fripp talks about later how they didn't even really have to do the U.S. tour, and they shouldn't have done it. Like, he wanted to end the band in that December after the first leg of the U.S. tour. No, there's another tour booked, and no one really wanted to do it. The interesting thing is that there's a lot of good music, at least, you know, that band got maligned for so many years. I was always a fan because it's kind of like, you know, it's just groovy. There's some groove to it. And even Fripp goes over it. People like to diss him about the way he plays in that band. I like that band. But yes.
So you
boom.
Got Bruford.
So they stay in. I think one of the things to talk about is like what's going on in Fripp's head at this point. So
yeah.
On the Islands box, as well as the Islands 40th anniversary, you get the Fripp trying to play the Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part 1 jam, and they're playing along with him, but it's nothing, you know, it's clear that, you know, that band is not going to be, is not going to do anything with it. But those ideas, he had already started doing those ideas actually in the summer of 71 during jams. Wow. He was doing some of the practice, I'll just say practicing, he was practicing some of those Lark's lines.
Got it.
You know, they were touring. Mahavishnu Orchestra was around at the time. We know he was heavily influenced. Like, that blew his mind. Yeah. Even it blew other people's mind. And yeah. I think he was very successful at melding that kind of thing. And then he had the right musicians. I mean, Wetton had been... Fripp wanted Wetton in the Islands band.
Oh,
he tried to get him in to just sing. No, I take that back. I apologize to get Crimson people piling on me. He wanted to get Wetton in, not just him, the band. They wanted to get Wetton in to play bass, and then Boz just would have been the singer. And at least everything I've read, Boz was fine with that. Wetton was the one who said, it's not really the right people for me. He didn't want to be involved in that band. But
then he was on this
Well,
one.
That, I, that was one of the first
David
people.
Cross, and you have Jamie Muir, who is... kind of this wacky percussionist performance artist doing his thing, which I think, you know, I've read these interviews with Bruford, and he's just, you know, he's all about drumming and the rhythms and all that stuff, and having Jamie there as kind of a counterpoint to his stuff. I think he loved it.
Well, and we have the videos, right?
You
can go see the videos of Jamie, the Beat Club show, which is just like, and the things he's doing. I mean, it's,
and then
that
he,
was him.
Then he up and leaves and becomes a monk.
Yeah. So, one thing that always sticks in my mind is because you learned a little bit about that stuff from the Young Person's Guide, right?
Yeah.
They talked about that era. And I always look at the one where Fripp talks about how, you know, he put his head forward and something swung by, and if his head was somewhere else, it would have gotten hit by this thing that Jamie's swinging around. And you can see a lot of this stuff in those videos. You know, he's spitting blood, he's smashing things, and, you know, they didn't kick him out. He left. Like, because at times it's
and
like...
And I think that they were... from when I read them looking back at it, because it's not a very long period of time that he was in the band.
You're really talking,
but I think it was
publicly October through January.
Yeah, and I think it was, but I think they were all, from what I've read, really influenced by his performance and his approach to music, and I think that was it propelled them into doing more things. He also famously, you know, at Bill Bruford's wedding, told John Anderson to read the autobiography of a yogi, which turned into Tales from Top of Graphic
Ocean. Yeah, I think people forget that Jamie Muir is directly responsible for Tales from Topographic Oceans. Yeah, that's the book he recommended at Bruford's wedding. And it's so funny to kind of... he was definitely an interesting character. I mean, he was involved in the music scene as it was, and again, all this stuff is out there already. You can know what went through, you know, Fripp's head to put this band together and kind of what they were. It was just so different.
It was quite a departure from what they were doing a year earlier.
Oh, totally. And the best thing is to, besides the album, is to listen to that live stuff from that tour. It's out there. It's just, even the songs, because Book of Saturday was called Daily Games, had some different lyrics. There was a lot of differences in some of the music. Some of it was fully formed, like both Lark's Tongues parts are somewhat fully formed.
Yeah.
Although those middle sections and kind of the ending, they never really did. You know, they never really did that coda. But came close to in some of these instances. And like I said, Easy Money was always a song, although there was a bit of Fallen Angel at the end, which is kind of odd to hear. But
when you have to remember, this is all happening in the course of like 2 years. So like the bits of Fallen Angel, it's like, oh, they use it. It's like, well,
right.
That was,
it's
like
not
8 months
now.
Later.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't. Well, yeah, because it's literally three albums in 2 years between, you know, that classic three. that we always talk about. But yeah, I think for the short amount of time he was in the band, they talked like that then. I was actually surprised that they have the same feelings that they had 50 years ago
right.
about him. I don't know. It was interesting because, you know, famously, he didn't tell them he left. He sent Robert a postcard.
Or he told the EG management that he was leaving.
But he sent for a postcard and, you know, whatever. But then, you know, before Jamie passed, his family called him. I think it was his brother or nephew or something called Fripp to tell him, you know, he's kind of, if there's anything you want to say. So he told him essentially the same thing, like back to him. And then they reported back that this is literally either the day before. And they say, you know, he kind of cracked a smile. So, yeah. I can, as a musician myself, I can see how they can think that way. I'm more surprised that essentially the same, like, definitely had an impact because they're pretty much saying the same thing they said then. And it's not just, you know, and
lip
it is because when I was younger and Bruford would say that, I'd be like, why are you saying, like, you know, like, how could you be influenced by him? You know what I mean? I'm talking about when I was a teenager and I was getting into Crimson and I was reading reviews
but
or whatever.
But it's very interesting because he was very, you know, his Bruford with his jazz and the whole thing.
Yeah.
I think coming from Yes, which was a very structured band, moving into Crimson and having him in this recent Rolling Stone interview, he talks about the fact that he'd only played with those other four people.
That was his only band. That was all he knew.
That was all he knew. So to be in this new environment where it's a bit more improvised and this other foil of this person who's playing percussion and drums as well, I'm sure was just this whole new world for him.
Yeah,
you know
it was. And then when Jamie left, he had a kind of, he was still Bruford, but that's when some of this percussion stuff started, you know? And that's I tell you, I don't listen to a lot of surround stuff, but this album I do because the Jamie Muir stuff, it's just so, because it's just, there's so much going on, it comes out of nowhere. But there's so many, a lot of it live is cacophonous and whatnot. Most of it on this album is very tasteful. Like this, like he does weird stuff, but it like hits an accent at a time, and it's part of the music. I mean, for me, particularly side two, like
side two is just great.
You know, when you get to the after during the middle of Easy Money, and he's just, you know, hit a bell or something, and it just kind of, and then, you know, the percussion just builds up and builds up, and the song ends. And then it goes into like those weird sounds, like in the beginning of Talking Drum, you know, like that wow, that's him like spinning this thing around. And it's like, you wouldn't have gotten that. And then the laugh at the end, that's, you know, just one of those old toys, but he had all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, he's credited with percussion and all sorts.
And he certainly was a master of all sorts. I did listen, later on, You'd see some of the things he did elsewhere in inexpensive albums or CDs or stuff. So I did listen to it. I mean, it's more definitely on the freer side of things, but it really fit for this band, right? Because it was a period where I was like, oh, you know, who needs Jamie Muir? Like, I like Starless and Red and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But there's just something about that, like I said, at least the live, he's doing whatever he wants. But on this, whether he toned himself down or they just did cut parts out, which I'm sure you can hear on some of the development. But actually, some of the stuff, is it on this one? David and it used to be called, it was like, you know, David and Jamie. It's like the early part of the Lark's Tongue songs were just the two of them. And some of the stuff, it's just those outtakes, it's just really beautiful stuff when it's just two or three of them kind of not doing, you know, not doing a lot of things.
Yeah.
So great air. I mean, I'll put a link in the description we did a podcast where we talked about, we came together to say we'll come up with our top three Crimson albums.
Yes.
Do that with other bands, but we haven't gotten to that yet. And this is my favorite Crimson album.
Yeah, but did it even make
it? It made number two.
It did.
It did.
That's right.
I think Red. Or maybe it was, yeah, I think it was Red Lark's Discipline. Or yes. Red Discipline Lark's. No, we were going to do that, and you're like, no, we can make a number two. But I still feel the same way. I can see, I mean, Red has more legs as far as time, right? It was a slow burner, and it influenced a lot of people who then became very well-known bands that then, you know.
Yeah, if I have to pick this album apart, I think it's just the, and I think I've said this before, it's just that beginning of Lark Stung's One is so quiet that I it's like I kind of, I don't know if I like it as a beginning.
Yeah. It's, I like
it. It goes on for a little, it's not like the beginning Bird Sounds on Close to the Edge.
Right.
But because it goes on for much longer.
Well, it does. And there's, you know, that's some of those kind of outtakes that they have are just them making those sounds. Yeah. And I it's cool. I liked it more once I knew what was going on, because it was always this, when's that part going to happen?
Yeah.
Once, it's like I had the same experience. I talked about Earthbound. I don't know how familiar you are, but the groon when they do the drum solo with the synthesizer, it just kind of comes in. If you're not expecting it, you know, kind of when I was a kid, I'd be like, ugh, you know, and it's kind of the same thing with this. But those sounds, and you know, he comes in with the kalimba, with the thumb piano. It's just so many different sounds that, again, I can make the connection between this and more like the double trio and the last band, the not eight-headed beast.
Yeah.
Because there was so much kind of more color going around it.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas,
yeah.
You know, you go from Starless with the four of them to the touring. But Red, I mean, it's only the three of them on the front. It's like you couldn't get any smaller than that,
right.
Even though there's other people on it. So, but it's just a fantastic album. And I mean, it's kind of cliche, but I appreciate his contribution more as I got older than when I was younger. I don't know if that makes
sense. Yeah, I think that I'm a little bit in your camp in the, like, what does Bruford need another drummer for?
Right, yeah. And it's funny because...
And what do you mean he's learning from it?
I know. But it is. Right, but when you listen to it, and then you're like, well, actually, he's not really playing drum, you know? It's funny because...
He's doing...
In the videos, you can see the Beat Club and these jams. Well, that's the good thing about the Beat Club is it's like a 20-minute jam, and that's what they were doing. But they weren't just doing one of those. They do two or three of those per night. And he comes and sits down at the little, he's got that little drum
that
kit.
Little kit.
And it's funny.
And then
because,
he gets up and smashes
it. But it's almost like I remember it was either 82, I think it was, 82, right, when After Beat was released. And the Crimson Tour, and we thought we were getting like Discipline. They're all there. And then he comes out. Bruford comes out and he's playing. They open Waiting Man playing. And then Adrian comes out and he's doing drums too. And then during Satori, there's a little drum set off the side and he's playing. I'm like, this is like Jamie Muir again. It's like the funny thing about Bruford, though, is that, yeah, he had that percussion after Jamie Muir, but he really went Jamie Muir later on with the backdrop of all the electronic drums. I mean, my gosh, right? It's like that interview with
Bruford. Anderson Bruford.
Yeah. No, the Union Tour, where he's saying,
where
you know,
he's the Hollandaise to Alan White's Meat and Potatoes.
Bruford has such a good sense of humor. He really does.
Well, he
really
didn't
does.
Say that. Some a reviewer
I know,
wrote
but,
that.
You know. But then he also talks about the bit where at the rock and roll show, he's like, nah, Alan can play that. You know, like he's just so funny that way. He's just.
It is kind of weird, though, that, I mean, that was during his not,
that, well,
not
that
playing.
Was real not playing. And.
Yeah, so he didn't want
to. No, I mean, it took 13 years, right? What was the John Wetton. Tribute was when he sat down publicly, and I'm sure because even though he talks about in the interview how he'd pass his drum set and occasionally he'd sit down, then he started.
He said it was like 2 years to get his chops back or whatever.
Yeah, but that you could tell just by the way he was smiling when he's just playing straight. I mean, they're just playing Let's Stick Together. It's not like it was anything. He looked like he was having a good time, and now he's out there. I mean, I wish I lived in England because I'd love to see him in a jazz club with that small band. That would be cool.
But and his whole point of that is, I'm not This isn't stadium rock. I'm not. This is for me.
Although he leaves the
for me to have.
He doesn't
fun.
Shut the door on anything in the future. I don't know if you, did you notice that at the end where he's like, "Well, we're doing this now, but who knows?" You know, like it just sounded like he was saying no, but not saying no now. Because was it the guy who said, "Are you going to do?" He said something about playing with somebody again, and he was like, "You know."
He goes,
no,
"I
no,
get
no, no.
I get asked every week if I'll play with if I would be playing with Yes again."
Oh well, that he's never gonna do. Come on.
Oh,
I didn't know he introduced the 50th anniversary show. In
yeah,
did you knew that?
Yeah.
Okay. Huh.
Well, there were a lot of people at that show.
That must
like,
be
Trevor Horn came up and sang "Tempest Fugit," and
when
you know
was
who
this?
Wasn't there?
John Anderson. I was going to say Chris Squire, and then I was like, no,
wow.
I don't want to hear that from Jay. John Anderson, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, anyways, we're getting a little far afield here. He never had to do anything else, but he did. It is.
No, and it was his own choice to stop doing music and to move into the religious world and then the art world,
right.
Apparently.
Oh, yeah. He was a big, big painter. And there were occasionally articles. I remember seeing some. He actually did a couple of interviews. I remember seeing one in a magazine like the mm-hmm. early 80s, and I picked it up, and it was just all art. And another. It's funny because it wasn't just him. Guy who played Jeffrey Hammond and Jethro Tull, another one, left Tull and did painting. And another guy, actually, the article may have been about like rock and roll people who gave it up to do painting. Well, some did, others didn't, right? I mean, some people who paint just kept doing it.
Yeah.
Grace Slick's another one. She was another one in that article. But what I find, you know, regardless of the fact of Bruford and Fripp, you know, still singing his praises, which is amazing. I can when I think about it, I can see not the impact that he had that kind of came all the way through to the present, like the three drummers,
right?
It's all the same kind of ethos that, and that's what he brought into the band.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was he was short-lived in the band, but his influence was pretty big.
Definitely. Yeah. We'll miss him.
Yeah. The other change on this was the lyricist changed. So
right.
Pete Sinfield, who we talked about a couple months ago having passed away, is no longer in the band, and we have Richard
Palmer James, who actually was one of the original founding members of
Supertramp,
and was in on the first Supertramp album. He worked
for years and years. Everyone was like, "Who is Richard Palmer James?
Right.
And is he really someone else as a pseudonym?" And
right,
all this
I remember
stuff.
That.
And no one knew who he was. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, "Oh, he was the guy from Supertramp." I'm like, "How come no one knew this?"
I know. Pre-internet age, right?
It is.
I mean, how'd you get your information? However you could.
No one knew.
But the lyrics totally changed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, although you can draw a line between Ladies of the Road and Easy Money, but regardless, he worked a lot with Wetton, and he wrote all the way through through Red.
Yeah, yeah.
And the lyrics are good.
Yeah.
No complaints about the lyrics. So, excellent album.
There
and rest in peace,
Jamie Muir.
All right, Prague will find a way.
If you want it to.